Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
WGR Sports Radio 550 presents
1-1. Perdula swings and fouls it off.
Sports Talk Saturday.
Towards the broadcast booth, and I make the catch on the foul ball.
On WGR.
I am very proud of myself.
Sports Radio 550.
I really hope that guy chugged a beer after that. You know, when you catch a foul ball and you catch it in a beer glass and then you chug the beer afterwards.
You know who I really think could pull that sort of feat off?
You think Pat can?
Oh, easily. I think Pat could do that.
Pat, you think you could chug a beer if you caught? Or, well, first off, can you think you can catch a beer, a ball in a beer glass, and then after that, chug the beer immediately afterwards?
The first part would definitely be harder than the second, but I can't say I've had any practice at it, but I wouldn't put it past myself.
All right,
how many foul balls have gone up to the broadcast booth when you've called games?
One has landed in the booth. One recently. There's been about two or three in my time. And some of the booths that we go into, especially even ours at Salem Field, the windows don't open in a way that allow for foul balls to come in. So A lot of times just have, you know, bounce off the plexiglass or whatever. But there have been a couple occasions when I was in Indy probably 7 or 8 years ago, a foul ball came in the booth, and in Charlotte 4 years ago, foul ball landed right next to me. So it's happened once or twice. You got to be ready.
Well, I hope, Pat, that if that happens again in your time calling for Bison's baseball, that you get a video of yourself catching the baseball and then, you know, going about that way like that guy did in the video. Because I definitely remember that video in particular.
Yeah, I hope it happens sooner rather than later, to be honest.
Well, Pat, first off, how you doing? It's been a while since we've talked, and obviously with everything that's going on in the world right now, we haven't had the chance to talk about really anything pertaining to baseball or hockey, for that matter, at all.
Yeah, you know, things are going well, obviously. You know, we're just kind of wading through everything and, you know, taking everything that comes at us as we go, and, you know, every day brings something different in good ways and in bad ways, but you know, looking forward to hopefully seeing sports start returning on a bigger scale. You know, we've seen golf and now NASCAR and some other individual type events, and you know, some of the news that's coming out recently about whether it be the NHL and the Players Association or the NBA, Major League Baseball, this is a kind of a critical time for them. So now we're kind of getting into that critical area where you know, if sports is going to come back this summer. We're going to find out pretty soon, I think.
Yeah. Well, I did want to get you on to talk a little bit about the Sabres and kind of just your thoughts on the season and where they go moving forward. But I also wanted to get you on to talk a little bit about baseball and kind of what's going on with negotiations for their return to play initiative. I know that things have kind of been back and forth between the MLB and the Players Association as well. But where are they kind of at right now with getting back to somewhat of normalcy? Because I know nothing will be normal for the rest of this year for baseball standards, but where are they kind of at right now?
Yeah, you know, the conversation kind of shifted from early on of how do we play close to a full season, maybe not 162 games, but 100 or more games. And as, you know, everything has kind of evolved and we see that, you know, maybe it's not the best idea to be playing into December anymore, which was one of the ideas that was floated. Maybe that truncated season of about 82 games, right around the halfway point of what would be a normal season, kind of make sense now. And in order to do that, the teams are going to have to get on the field pretty soon, to be honest. You look back, spring training was in full force. There was about a week and a half, 2 weeks to go in spring training when baseball and all sports shut down. There's going to have to be another period of that. So whether it be 2 weeks or 3 weeks of spring training, you're looking at adding extra time before you actually get into gameplay. So, if an 82-game season is going to happen, it'll have to probably start right around July 1st, July 4th, somewhere in that range. So now you're starting to work backwards from there. And is it middle of June when you have your team start to take shape again and start going to the locations that you'd be playing in? And, hearing your conversation earlier about the NHL's issues of about 15 to 20% of the league being from overseas, well, how do you bring all your potential players, whether it be a 50-man major league roster, bringing them back to the cities that they're going to be playing in? And are there certain travel restrictions or quarantines that will have to take place? As the Blue Jays up in Toronto, that's something that would potentially be a hurdle for baseball to deal with. If a team had to travel into Canada, would they have to face the 14-day quarantine, which the NHL has been talking through as well? So there's a lot that goes into it, and the players and the owners have to still agree to something. They actually did come to an agreement back in March originally, and things like service time, and there was even an agreement on the contract for the season, for players' contracts, and the players actually received a sum of money up front whether or not there was going to be a season. And now that is a point of contention again, and a lot of what you've heard over the last couple of weeks is players and owners trying to negotiate privately, but also there has been some public comments by players, just talking about not wanting to go down the road of potentially giving up more that they've already potentially given up. So there's a lot going on behind the scenes, and I think players and the owners, I read something from Jeff Paston today laying it out really well about how this is really a critical week coming up, and I couldn't agree more with what he wrote today.
Right, because, if they really do want to get the season going again and get back on time, they've got to come up with something here pretty quick. Do you think that they have their internal deadline or have a internal deadline at all as to if this doesn't happen when, then there's no season? Or do you think that they're in a situation where I feel like the NHL is kind of in this situation where it's like, it's imperative we finish this season. It's imperative that we get the rest of the season in, or we get this season in general, and we have sports happening, whether it be hockey or baseball in this matter.
Yeah, I think the thing hockey and basketball have going for them is, there were only a handful of games in the regular season potentially left, and you can jump right into the playoffs right away. Where baseball, you've got to play out a regular season. And even if it's only half a season, you have to get started by July. So, building in those 2 or 3 weeks for spring training, building in time for your players to be able to get to those sites. Yes, there has to be a deadline, at least among the different groups, to say, we have to get started by this date, otherwise we're in danger of not having a season. I don't know if there's a hard and fast, date where if we don't get a deal done by this day, there will be no season, because I think there's still going to be a lot of impetus to, whether it be playing doubleheaders or getting creative, there will be a lot to try and salvage some portion of the season. But the further we go down this road, and if we get into June, then definitely the players and the owners will be on the clock to get something done, or stare down the barrel of not having a season at all.
So at this point, it seems like that the main discussion points with the return to play, they have got the schedule figured out, they've got pay, all that stuff, and even some locations, it seems like they maybe have some of that hammered down, maybe not completely finalized, but it seems like at this point it's the health and all those type of regulations that they're trying to agree upon. Is that correct?
That's a lot of it. Just the simple things about, one of the points that the owners made in their 67-page, proposal to the players, it lays everything out from, right now the owners are proposing that the players don't shower at the ballpark after the game, they would have to go back to wherever they're staying to do all that. That way you kind of limit the amount of interaction and the areas you have to clean and things like that. So while something like that is not a sticking point, these are all the things behind the scenes that are being discussed. You know, you talk about maybe 50 players, but then the health of the people that have to work at the ballpark, or the bus driver who takes a team from their team hotel to the ballpark, the clubhouse attendants, you know, all the different people that will have to interact with the players and to keep everybody safe in the end is, I think, a lot of it. And, you know, it seems like the contract is a big issue right now. I think cooler heads will prevail in the end, but that is something that right along with the health and safety of the players and everybody involved with the game, that is probably maybe number two, it seems, at least in the quote-unquote public negotiations that kind of happened through the media, that really is maybe the next point that really has to get figured out very quickly in order for things to progress to that next step.
Now, this question, I think, immediately impacts you, Pat, with the future of what's going to happen with minor league baseball, obviously, because, you know, the impact with the majors is going to be a huge talking point. But where's this leave minor league baseball and the future of the season for the Bisons?
Well, it's something that we kind of, are waiting for the majors to settle things out from their perspective and then see what that would mean for minor league baseball. It's really hard to answer that question because there's so many different variables. Like, you know, baseball will be able to recoup a lot of the money that they lose. Maybe not a lot, but some of the money they're going to lose this year from not having fans in the stands through TV contracts. And that's not something minor league baseball can do. Mm-hmm. Just with the way the minors are set up, minor league baseball is driven by fans being in the ballpark. So that really is a big question is, you know, at some point, you know, what happens if you cannot have fans in the stands? Because if minor league baseball were to start, it would potentially be 2 to 3 weeks after a major league season starts. So if we're talking mid-July and there's still no fans allowed in a ballpark, and, you know, we're talking about not even having fans in the stands in Orchard Park for Bills games potentially this year. You know, we're looking down the road, how can you have, you know, a certain amount of fans at Salem Field or any other minor league ballpark if there are, you know, very big concerns of public safety. So it's something that we have to really kind of weigh and, you know, see where everything shakes out. But it really starts with the majors and then and goes from there. And, you know, it's one of those things that I think we will have an answer sooner rather than later. And in a minor league season, it's definitely something that we've gone from, all right, when is things going to start up? When are things going to start up again? To, you know, just kind of waiting and seeing.
Pat Malacaro, the play-by-play man for the Buffalo Bisons, joining us here on the Western Hotline. He also works on the Buffalo Sabres radio network as a part-time fill-in guy for Brian Koziel. He also works a lot of the home games at KeyBank Center. And Pat, want to shift now the talk to hockey, just obviously with how the proposal for the 2014 playoff now leaves out the Sabres moving forward. That obviously is going to end their season. Just want to get your general thoughts on what you thought of this season and maybe the level of disappointment or the level of hope that you have for the team going forward. Just your thoughts overall on how things kind of played out this year.
Well, I think it's a mixed bag. And, you know, you look back to, Ralph Kruger. I'll start there. And a head coach that really had the players believing in what he was trying to build and develop. And I don't know that it was something that you can say was a certainty in the locker room for the X amount of past years. And that is, I think that's a big thing to remember here is with Ralph Kruger, he had the buy-in from the players. You saw more structure in their play, whether or not that translated to wins and losses. You know, we saw how it played out in the end, and certainly the team faded in the second half of the season, the team has their faults. But I don't think you can look at the coaching staff and say, you know, they were one of the bigger reasons why the team faltered this year. I think you just look at it, and, you know, I listened to your conversation with Derek, and you guys were going through some of the potential free agents and players that could be, should be, maybe not be on this roster next year. And I think you have to really look hard at that. And this is going to be a very interesting offseason because I think everything we've come to know since the salary cap era took place might be out the window because, you know, teams are not going to have the ability to spend the money potentially in a salary cap. Well, you know, if the salary cap is an issue, it's going to be an issue for all 31 teams because the league was built in a way that, you know, you can't foresee something like this happening and revenue not being there. So how do teams and how does that affect unrestricted free agency? How does that affect contracts? You know, all these different things. It's a very tough time to really gauge, you know, what the offseason is going to bring and you know, what players maybe should be on this roster or potential players you would target beyond just the generalities of what types of players you want. It's really going to be a really interesting offseason, whenever that is.
Last thing I want to ask you here, Pat, real quick. Derek and I discussed this a little bit, too, right off the bat of the show, just with kind of, you know, obviously the Sabres now 9 seasons out from being in a playoff spot, 3 seasons of being, you know, one of the bottom-feeding teams of the NHL, and obviously the Sabres are just kind of spinning their wheels in the mud here with everything that's going on, and the question now is what the future of Jason Botterill is, and maybe even Ralph Krueger, if especially if they decide to move on from a GM and the new GM comes in and moves on. But I'm almost in the mindset of I don't know how much more change I really want to go through. I know that they've got probably a 9-month period now here coming up where if they make a change, they'll have plenty of time to make those internal changes and to kind of evaluate what's going on. But I don't know if the organization is in that mindset, and I don't know if they want to be in that mindset, but I just want your thoughts on whether or not, you know, you're thinking, you know, that a possibility of a change of GM could happen, or do you think that they're going to try and ride this out again for another season and see what happens?
Could happen, sure, but I'll go back to there's so much uncertainty of, you know, what's going to happen and what type of offseason this is going to be. Is it going to be truncated? In all compressed and more compact than it has been in previous years. So when I look back at it, sure, there are obviously a lot of different roster constructions you could go through and players that just have not worked out. For every Dominique Cahoon that has been brought in, or Curtis Lazar, who was a nice acquisition for this team, there have been other players that have worked the other way. But I look at it and I really think, you know, with this time right now and so much uncertainty and so much up in the air, I don't know that it's the right time. I feel it's not the right time to be making another change. And then you add in the point of, you know, flipping over GMs and coaches every couple of years. That just compounds the point, I think, even further.
Yeah.
I wouldn't make the move. And I think, you know, if just because the calendar doesn't lend itself to that this year, I'm fine with that. I think you have one more year to see how things play out. And if the Sabres are still in this same type of mode where they're not potentially contending for a playoff spot by March, well, then that makes your decision a lot easier. But I think as of right now, if a decision has to be made in the near future, I would stick with what the Sabres have and I would figure it out from there. And then, you know, you trust your GM and your head coach and you go from there.
Well, Pat, it's always a pleasure chatting with you, whether it's on the air or in person. But, you know, I hope all remains well with you during these times. And hopefully sooner rather than later, we'll be talking more about baseball, more about hockey and actual games and not just, you know, everything that's kind of going on right now.
Looking forward to it. Same to you, Brayton. Appreciate it.
Yep. Thanks, Pat. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Pat Malcarl joining us here on the West Hur Hotline. We'll go to break, and when we come back, we'll replay Jason Alexander from Howard and Jeremy yesterday morning. Really, really great chat. Of course, if you don't know, Jason Alexander is Howard Simon's cousin, so he was able to get the chance to talk, and obviously it kind of stems from the Seinfeld draft, which took place last Friday, not yesterday, but last Friday, the Seinfeld draft happened. Jason Alexander's character, George Costanza, was selected third overall by Bulldog, and then yesterday we got the chance to talk with him. So we'll replay that entire interview for you. Lots of great stories, lots of great things to come from that, and then we'll wrap things up here on Sports Talk Saturday on WGR.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
It's Howard Simon and Jeremy White.
You have no idea of the magnitude of this thing. If she is allowed to infiltrate this world, then George Costanza, as you know him, ceases to exist. You see, right now, I have relationship George, but there is also independent George. That's the George you know, the George you grew up with. Movie George, coffee shop George, liar George, bawdy George.
I love that George.
Me too. And he's dying, Jerry. If relationship George walks through this door, he will kill independent George. A George divided against itself cannot stand.
On WGR, Sports Radio 550.
Welcome back. Thanks for hanging out with us. Howard and Jeremy and Brayton here on this lovely Friday morning. And it is time for Mystery Guest. That, of course, one of the great clips, great moments in the history of the Seinfeld show. We're excited to have the man who was taken third in the Seinfeld draft by Bulldog last week.
Star of stage, screen, and television. Legitimately, all three. Jason Alexander with us right now. And Jason, thanks for coming on our show this morning. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Howie. How are you, my
okay, brother? See, you already blew the interview. Nobody calls me that around here. Nobody knows that's what I'm referred to, you know? Shoot, my cover's blown now.
Blown.
Yeah.
Blown.
I actually...
Listen, for all your listeners, I'm just going to give it away. For all your listeners, the only reason I'm doing this is Howard Simon is my little baby cousin.
Yeah, well, that's what I wanted to ask. My first question was, you know, you're pretty popular. Obviously, people notice you in public. When you're out and people come up to you and they say, hey, aren't you? And you answer, yes, that's right. I'm Howard Simon's cousin.
Howard Simon's cousin, of course. That's the first thing that comes out of my mouth.
Yeah, especially when you're in Buffalo.
And then I go from the Buffalo market and they go, I'm sorry, what?
Hey, when you mentioned my name when you were here with the BPO, there was three or four people applauding.
Let me tell you, at least three or four.
I did want to actually throw you a curveball to start, okay, before we get into Seinfeld and your movies and your Broadway career. You've been in Buffalo before. You were here a few years ago. You worked, you did your show and worked with the BPO, the Philharmonic Orchestra. But you were also here in 1980 shooting a movie called The Burning. Do you remember that at all?
I do. I remember it, and not only do I remember it, I remember... For many, many reasons. One, it was my first movie, which was like a huge deal. I remember it because the Buffalo chicken wing had not yet become a national phenomenon.
Right.
And so, you know, you got a day off in Buffalo, and by the way, the locals are wonderful, friendly, warm. I would go up to a guy and go, "Hi, can you recommend a place to eat?" And they go, that way. And they name something, and you'd say, oh, is that good? And they go, it's food.
It's doable.
And I'd say, well, how far is it? And they'd say, you know, 2 or 10 blocks, you know. <It's> very... But we'd get to where, we'd get to the, I think it was a bar, basically, that mm-hmm. the guy had recommended. And we sat down, and we ordered a beer, and we said, yeah, I said, what's the local delicacy? What do I have to eat? And they said, you got to try the wings.
Right.
I went, okay, wings. And they went, mild, medium, or spicy? And I went, I'm a man. Give them to me spicy.
Oh, no, no,
that's
no.
When all my hair fell out.
Oh, shortly boy.
After that.
That was a really big mistake on your part.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, it's funny, though, and now this is how you tell if you're from Western New York or not. We call them wings. Anybody outside of here calls them buffalo wings.
Oh, sure. Yeah, so, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay, I wanted to, of course, ask you about Seinfeld. Everybody, I'm sure, is waiting to hear. So when you read for the role of George, I assume they cast it and you read for the role. When you did, what did you think of the character, and what did you think of whatever you had learned about the premise of the show at that point? And had you gotten insight from Jerry Seinfeld at that point?
Not when I auditioned. When I auditioned, Hal, it was... So most of the audition process for everybody else had happened in Los Angeles. I still lived in New York, and they had gone through a whole bunch of people in L.A. I actually think they had, what I've heard since, is they made some offers to some pretty prominent people who, for whatever reason, didn't do the job. And so they finally said, you know, we should probably put some people on videotape in New York and see if there's any contenders there. So they hired a casting director in New York who had nothing to do with the show, and said, just here's the kind of guy we're looking for. He's a sidekick, you know, so not a leading man, kind of a character actor of this age range. Put like 20 guys on tape, and I got the call to do that. So I go down. I do not have the pilot script. I have 4 pages of a scene from the pilot script. I don't have Jerry. I don't have Larry David. I don't have anybody connected with the show to say, you know, what is this about? How is this supposed to come off? And if anybody's heard me tell the story before, I apologize because it's the same story. But it read to me like a Woody Allen movie. It seemed like Woody Allen dialogue to me.
Yeah.
So I went, oh, you know, there's an idea. So I didn't wear glasses at the time. I went out and, you know, borrowed a pair of glasses. And not only did I do a thick New York accent, I literally did Woody Allen. I was, you know, sputtering and stuttering like Woody Allen, and you know, it was just a shot in the dark, and I thought, yeah, well, cute idea, but I'm sure that's not what they want. And I walked away from that thinking, well, you know, it was something to do, but I'm not going to get this show. And a week later, Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld called me and said, hey, we loved your tape, we want to fly you to LA to read for the network. And it was when I flew out and met the guys, and they said, you know, we love everything you're doing. Love the New York, maybe not quite so identifiable as Woody Allen, but everything else about it is great. And that's when I really, for the first time, met Larry and Jerry and read for the network and got it on that day. But what I knew of the character going into the show was less than nothing. I knew that it was sort of in my head, it was a Woody Allen-esque kind of guy, whatever that meant, you know, pseudo-intellectual, a little bit hapless. And the discovery for me that he was in some ways an alter ego for Larry David happened somewhere in the first 10 episodes when there was a situation in one of the episodes, and I can't remember what it was, but it seemed preposterous to me. And I said to Larry David after the table reading that I would need some help because, you know, this would never happen to anybody, but if it did, I don't think anyone would really react like this. So what was he thinking? And Larry, you know, didn't bat an eye. He said, I don't know what you're talking about. This happened to me, and this is exactly what I did. And
that helps.
That is when I kind of went, aha.
Yeah.
I started using Larry. I really started trying to bring a little bit of some of Larry's physicality into the role, and then I really started watching Larry's comedic sensibility and trying to pull from that.
How did they, or what did they know of you? I'm trying to remember the timeline. At that point, you would have already been on Broadway in some prominent shows, right? You would have had Pretty Woman on your resume already?
Yeah, just barely. So I think there was a very tiny connection because I had won the Tony Award in June of 80, and I had done Pretty Woman right after it. And Gary Marshall, who did not really want me for Pretty Woman, but became a big fan of mine once I was doing the role.
Wow.
I think Gary Marshall of course, is the brother of Penny Marshall.
Yep.
Penny Marshall was the ex-wife of Rob Reiner. Rob Reiner was the head of Castle Rock, which was producing Seinfeld. And I think a little bit of hey, this kid might be okay for you, might have passed through the line.
I want to ask you more about Broadway in a second, but so you're on that show for 9 years. As an outsider watching, I think everybody would agree, it looked like you guys were having a blast and you worked so well together, the group of four. What was it like working, because you've worked with so many different people over the years, working with that cast and on that show for 9 years?
Heaven. I used to say to my wife, Nana, all the time, I'd come home at the end of the week and I go, they're going to find out they don't have to pay me for this, and then they're going to pull all the money back. It was the greatest working situation I've ever had in my life, because, you know, the thing that nobody thinks about when you're looking at a television show, especially a successful one, is it is the product of an arranged marriage. None of us knew each other. And, you know, we were compatible people, but we were very different people with very different lives, very different backgrounds and experiences. And somehow that foursome just meshed beautifully. We liked each other. We liked working with each other. We liked laughing with and because of each other. And that happened very quickly. So it was a great relationship, which made for a great work environment. And then these brilliant casting directors somehow would go out week after week after week and find these extraordinary, funny, offbeat, talented people to come in and do either, you know, create a character for many episodes, or sometimes they'd come on and do a scene, but be such a home run that it would go into the lexicon of, you know, a man hands or a low talker or, you know, whatever it might be, with the soup Nazi or whatever. And so the entire bench of the show just became a glorious group of people. And that's why for the finale episode, which, you know, a lot of people have issues with the finale episodes, and I understand it, and I don't necessarily push back against it, but it was an organic way to bring all those amazing people who had scored for us on the show back to do the final episode with us and celebrate with us. So emotionally, that just it was a great way to go out.
We are with Jason Alexander on our Wester Hotline. Last week, Jason, on our show, we all talked about Jerry Stiller, and we talked about his character on the show, Frank Costanza. And you wrote a magnificent piece about him that I saw in the New York Times. Could you talk a little bit about Jerry Stiller?
Yeah, well, as I more or less laid out in that article, you're just a few years younger than me, but, you know, we both kind of probably experienced a little bit of them on the Ed Sullivan Show. Stiller and Miro were a staple of the Ed Sullivan Show, and then all through the 60s and 70s, they were popping up on variety shows and guest shows. But when I started going to the theater, that's when I started to see both Jerry and Ann, and I was fully aware that he was quite a brilliant actor, aside from being this really wonderful sketch comic. So I was a huge, huge fan, and I always thought Jerry Stiller looked a little bit like my actual dad anyway. So when they finally brought him on to be on the show, first of all, I knew exactly who he was. I could quote huge chunks of his career. I saw him do things in the theater that most people were not aware of. So when he showed up, I was just drooling all over him and going, oh, my God, I saw you in this, and then you did that. And so he was so touched, and we immediately had this lovely bond. And then he was, you hear everybody saying it, he was one of the sweetest, most generous, most humble guys, with this really quirky, offbeat sense of humor, and just a delicious human being to work with. So happy to be with us, grateful to be with us, and we were so grateful to have him there. You know, I think he was so good that it went from being a role that, you know, might have shown up once a season, twice a season, into he eventually did 26 episodes or 28 episodes with us, because he was just so good we couldn't get enough of him.
You talked about, you know, the 9 years is heaven. You've done multiple TV series. You've done movies. You've been on Broadway in some fantastic shows. Do you prefer one type of work over the other? Is there a favorite thing you like to do? And you've also been behind the camera as a director.
Yeah. I do love to direct, and most of the focus of my career right now is on that side of things. But as an actor, I will never give that up, it's not that I prefer one medium over the other, because they all have positives and they all have negatives. you know, movies are very romantic. They come out, and when they're good, they're so good, and there's something very exalted about being in the movies. I can tell you, most of the time, making a movie is like watching paint dry. It is just so tedious, and so pressure filled at the same time, because the meter is running, and you have to get it in this moment, and you're under rehearsed. You know, there's all kinds of things. The thing that I love most, and I think I do best with, is performing in front of a live audience. Now, it doesn't mean that you can't have cameras there. Seinfeld, to me, was more theater than film. Even though we had four cameras on that show, we were always playing for the live audience, and I didn't worry about the cameras. I just worried about the audience. So there's something about the immediate, spontaneous, and kind of scary interaction, you know, the especially in theater. You start this illusion, and the audience goes on that ride, but if you screw it up, you've killed it for the entire experience. So there's a tightrope effect to it, and it really is, I think, the most challenging and most rewarding kind of work an actor can do if they really care about their craft.
More coming up from Howard and Jeremy's interview with Jason Alexander next here on WGR. Welcome back into Sports Talk Saturday on WGR. More of Howard and Jeremy's conversation with Seinfeld actor known as George Costanza, Jason Alexander, here on WGR.
As you've met people over the years, I always wondered, Jason, the reaction you would get. Like, your show here with the BPO, I'm sorry, was at Kleinhans, was singing, was dancing. You're accomplished in both of those areas. And I wonder if you get a reaction from people who know you for your TV work and go, huh, had no idea. You sing and dance.
Yeah, it's funny. Well, you know, you really have to narrow it down, because if they'd really have to only know me from Seinfeld,
right?
Go, I never saw that coming, because crazily enough, most of the rest of my TV work that is successful was in musicals. I did the musical of Bye Bye Birdie for television. I did the musical of Christmas Carol for television. I did the musical for Cinderella for television. So there's a lot of people who only know me from television who go, oh yeah, he's a song and dance man. But if you're just a Seinfeld fan, not only do you not know that I can do that stuff, but it just seems wrong.
But you've won you're a Tony Award winner, so I mean it's very good. But I'm biased. A couple minutes left with Jason Alexander on our Western Hotline. I did want to ask you a little bit about sports, since we are a sports station and there are sports connections in your stories. One of them is Seinfeld, and the others are not. I said to you, I was watching a roundtable you guys had done with Larry David. Tell the story about the episode you had, and your character worked for the New York Yankees. Tell a little bit about the story with Derek Jeter and Bernie Williams.
Sure. Well, first of all, the whole notion that people would come up to me based on the fact that George Costanza was the assistant to the traveling secretary for the New York Yankees and ask me in my real life for inside stories and inside information about the Yankees organization was so ludicrous, because you know, because you're my cousin, I am a sports moron. I follow no sport, no person, no nothing. I barely watch a game. I mean, I'm really, I should trade in my genitals. I am not a man. But so we were doing this episode where shortly after they had just won the World Series, Bernie Williams and Derek Jeter come on to guest on the show, and it's the episode where George is showing them, you know, what they're doing wrong in batting. They're at a batting practice, and I'm knocking them out and, you know, dissing these two guys. And we show up. Now, I had not met them. There was no rehearsal with them, so I'm literally walking out to the location to do the shot with these two guys. And I turn to Jerry Seinfeld on the way, and I go, quick, tell me so I don't embarrass myself. Which one is Bernie Williams? Which one's Derek Jeter?
It's okay. You know, it's not like Jeter is one of the most famous ball players in the history of the sport. Don't worry about it.
Well, wait, it gets worse, Howard, because Jerry's response to me was, well, their names are written on their jerseys.
That would help. That might be a tip-off. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Now, you also crossed paths. You would have worked with Yogi Berra and Barry Bonds. I wanted to hear your Barry Bonds story.
Yeah, I worked with three greats, Yogi Berra, Barry Bonds, and Scottie Pippen.
Right.
Scottie Pippen, when I was working with him, I had no idea who he was. I knew he was a basketball player,
mm-hmm.
and I thought he must be good because why would they use him in a commercial?
Yeah.
And he couldn't have been nicer. I had the greatest day with Scottie Pippen, and told me his whole story about growing up and you know getting into college and his big growth spurt in college, and then you know turning his fortunes around. But Barry Bonds, I had a fantastic time with Barry Bonds. We were doing a KFC commercial, and we were shooting up in Giant Stadium up in San Francisco. And, you know, Barry was at the height of his fame at that time. And so he had people. You know, he had an entourage.
Sure.
And shortly before he was going to come out onto the onto the field and we were going to start rehearsing, somebody, I'm guessing his publicist, came up to me and said, by the way, Mr. Alexander, Mr. Bonds has certain regulations when he's working, so we're going to ask that you call him Mr. Bonds, not Barry. He is Mr. Bonds. Do not look him directly in the eye.
Oh, my goodness.
And do not, under any circumstance, ask him anything about baseball or the Giants organization.
Sure.
And I said, okay, great, got it. Thank you very much. Good to know, good to know. And then Barry comes out a second later, and somebody says, Mr. Bonds, this is Jason Alexander. And now, of course, he towers over me, and I take his hand. I look him directly in the eye, and I go, so, Barry, how do you think the team's going to do this year? And he cracks up. He is just hysterical. He said, somebody got to you, didn't they? And I went, yeah, kind of. And the fact that he loved it. He loved it. I know in my life, somehow, at some occasions, people have said, oh, here's the do's and don'ts about Jason Alexander. Hmm. And I go, who made this stuff up?
Yeah, I'm curious what the list is. Yeah.
So I just assumed that the same was true for him.
Okay.
And so I just, you know, I took the bull by the horns. And we had a great day. We had so many laughs. He did not have to. He took me into the clubhouse. He took me into the locker room. He really gave me the grand tour of the stadium. And I had a great, great time with him. Hmm. And then here's the follow-up to that story. So I think you may know I'm a Magic enthusiast, so I go to the Magic Castle here in Los Angeles, and this was only about 3 or 4 years ago. And I go into the castle, and I walk in to sit in a showroom one night, and the only available chair is in front of this African-American couple, and I sit down in front of the guy, and I say, you have nothing to worry about. I'm 5'5". You're going to have no trouble seeing over me. And that's all that happens, right? We watch the show. And now I get up and I turn around to leave, and this black gentleman is now looking at me, and he goes, what's the matter, man? We all look alike to you?
Oh, went, my goodness.
What? What? And he smiles and goes, it's Barry Bonds, man.
Oh, oh man.
Well, let me tell you, this was like, you know, a decade after he left baseball.
Right.
He, all that bulk, all that size,
he was smaller.
Gone.
Yeah.
He looked so, I couldn't have picked him out in a million years.
That's funny.
And I just went, oh my God, Barry.
Wow. You know?
But he was a tremendous guy. And Yogi was a great guy. Yogi, I had so much fun with. Your dad had worked with him when he was with the Mets, and I was able to tell him all that good stuff. And Yogi was just, Yogi, I actually may have saved Yogi's performance because Yogi couldn't memorize lines, and he had all the dialogue in this thing. So he was on cue cards, and his performance was so stiff because he was doing things like, I really like the great taste of Miller Lite. And, you know, and the director's going, yeah, Yogi, just have fun with it, throw it away, you know, just enjoy it, you know, and they can't get him off that reading, right?
Yeah.
And after about 10 takes, I casually go over to the director and I go, you have to rewrite the cards. He's reading it one line at a time, the way it's laid out on the cards. If you make a whole sentence on a line, he'll read a whole sentence.
Oh, my goodness.
And they rewrote the cards, and then he was great. And he never knew. I never said anything. But, you know. But yeah, I've had for a guy who knows nothing about sports, I've worked with some of the greats.
Wow. Hey, final thing, because if we go longer, I owe you overtime, and I don't think I can afford the Screen Actors Guild rate. I'm going to ask you a question, and I'm curious because I think it's a question most listeners would want me to ask. Do you have a favorite episode or episodes from Seinfeld or favorite moments, or is that akin to asking you which of your children do you like the most?
It is, which is a terrible question. In my case, it's my youngest. But, you know,
wow. Wow, I've got some dirt.
No,
all right.
My oldest son hates when I do that joke. He hates that joke. you may have heard me say, I can't point to a favorite Seinfeld episode because I tend to remember them for the things happening around them rather than the things in them. So it's hard for me to separate them out. But I can tell you the two that I point to all the time as being really significant. One was the Chinese restaurant, which mm-hmm. was a very early episode. Our show was not a hit at all. We were hanging on by a thread. The network came to the table read for that episode, couldn't understand it, couldn't figure it out. There was really no story. There was no characters. It was just funny. And they had a little tantrum, and they walked out. And, you know, any normal person would say, hey, you know, our show is, we're right on the bubble. We don't know if we're going to make it. And the network didn't seem to like the script. Most producers would go, maybe we should do something else. Larry David and Jerry Seinfeld said, well, they didn't say we couldn't do it. So they put their heads down, and we did that episode. And it was the first time that I remember thinking, these guys have integrity. These guys know what they want to do, they know what they want to make, and no one's going to take them off their game, and they're willing to risk it all, you know, to do what they believe in. And I thought that was really noble. But the one that I think changed our fortunes was the contest, the abstinence contest.
Yeah.
You know, we were doing okay. We were certainly on the air. We were in a coveted time slot right after Cheers in our third season. And, you know, we had an audience, but we weren't a hit show. And then we did that episode, and the world went crazy. They could not believe that the subject was being done comedically, being done respectfully, being done so daringly. And it kind of set the bar for our show, and it brought us a whole new audience that we never lost and only built on from that point. And we pretty much knew we had job security from that episode on. So I think we probably point to that one a lot.
The magnificent Jason Alexander, kind enough to join us on our Western Hotline. Thank you very much for coming on with Mr. Alexander. We appreciate it
very
much.
My pleasure. Say hello to your mother.
I will, and love to the family.
All right, my cousin, I love you. Take care. Good to be with you.
That was George Costanza himself, Jason Alexander, joining Howard and Jeremy yesterday on WGR. Thanks again to everyone that joined the show today, from Brian Duff to Nick Katsunika from NHL.com, and also thanks to Pat Malacaro joining me to talk some baseball and hockey as well. And that'll do it for another edition of Sports Talk Saturday here on WGR. Thanks again to all those guys for joining me here. Thanks again to Derek Kramer for producing. I'm Brayton Wilson. We're off tomorrow. We're also off on Monday for the Memorial Day celebrations, honorings of all the people who have fought for our country and have made the ultimate sacrifice. So we thank you for tuning in. We thank the veterans and everyone that has served this country well. And we'll be back with live programming on Tuesday morning with Howard and Jeremy. So thanks again, everybody, for tuning in. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. Thanks for listening to WGR.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.